So, have you heard the word?
I just did. And so did a lot of people in the mid-70s picking up Dutch imports, believing it was an unreleased Beatle track.
Yeah.
I think the more critical listeners among us could divine that it really wasn't. There was something off,
yeah.
But you'd wondered what the hell it was.
I think by the time I heard it, I already knew it wasn't them. You know, someone already told me about this track.
Mm. I'm not sure exactly when I heard it first, but it was the kind of thing where you reach a certain level in your fandom, you've got all the catalog releases. And this was back in the day when you can go to the ads in the back of Rolling Stone magazine and send away for these catalogs of, you know, Dutch imports, we'll call them, of unreleased Beatle material, live Beatle material. And it's like, oh, really? I got to have this. And they were reasonably priced back then. And what you'd end up with were these vinyl collections. Typically early on, they were plain white cardboard sleeves with a paper insert slid under the shrink wrap. And, you know, they would purport to have live recordings. They would purport to have studio outtakes and, you know, demos and whatever else. And very often, because we had so little to go on, there was so little information out there, you would accept what you were hearing as, oh, I guess it is what they say it is. Have you heard the word, an unreleased Beatles song from whatever year? Certainly, it sounds Lennon-esque, the vocal. But
you know, Maurice Gibb.
It's Maurice Gibb, exactly, who was producing the band Tintin.
Yeah.
You remember those guys?
No.
They had that one hit, Toast and Marmalade for Tea.
No.
Let me
play. Sounds like something I don't want to remember.
It's all right. You know, it's one of those things. Here, let's play a bit of it, and this may jog your memory.
Toast and marmalade for tea. Sailing ships upon the sea aren't lovelier than you or the games I see you play. You more lovely than the day when the sun is in your eyes. I see through your disguise all the games I see you play.
Remember that at all? No?
Nope.
Okay. It was one of those things.
I'm glad you don't?
It's not terrible. Come on. It's a one-hit wonder. But this is what we know about Maurice Gibb, the one who sang least leads in the Bee Gees, the twin of Robin, is he could do an uncanny Lennon impression.
Yeah.
And that's what this was. It was them. It was not meant to come out as a record, but it did come out as a record.
I think he did a corny Lennon impression in the Sgt. Pepper film as well. He was trying to be like the Joker of the group, and it was like,
less said the better. But he was married to Lulu, and he was a neighbor of Ringo's, and they used to pal around quite a lot. And there was these little films they used to make, these little personal video comedic things that you can find some of them on YouTube actually.
Yes.
So look for that, listeners. But this was a record that came out, and it was meant as a piss take, but it was credited to the Futt.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
And the flip side was Futting the Futt.
Yeah.
Futting the Futts.
Yeah.
On Beacon Records in England.
So. A little bit like Do the Oz, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Do the Do.
Yeah. Like but I mean, you know, in the '70s. Definitely when there was a kind of desperation for more Beatles product and rumors of them getting together. And
that's the word, desperation.
Right.
You wanted anything.
Yeah, and so then there was Klaatu.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
What was the name of that track?
Calling Occupants?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Covered by the Carpenters.
Right, and so there was rumors that that was the Beatles. Again, by the time I heard it, I already knew it wasn't them.
Right, right.
I remember the first time I heard the Ruttles, I Must Be in Love.
Uh-huh.
And I heard that on the radio, and I thought, wow, something from A Hard Day's Night I haven't heard before.
Right,
but that lasted
guitar.
Maybe a few seconds.
Exactly.
You know? Another one.
Cheese and Onions.
Cheese and Onions.
Now
that was ridiculous.
But it first surfaced on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
I believe it was in the fall of 76, the same year that Lorne Michaels went on inviting the Beatles to regroup on his stage.
Yeah.
And then Eric Idle was a host for the show. And I think that they showed It Must Be in Love, but they also, on one of those appearances, showed a Lennon-esque clip of Neil Innes doing his take on Imagine, basically, sitting at the piano doing Cheese and Onions.
Well, and A Day in the Life.
Yeah, yeah. But this was prior to the Ruttles special.
Right.
And it ended up, I think, on the same Dutch import of Indian Rope Trick. Cheese and Onions is on there. And it says, you know, unreleased Lennon song.
That's right. And I remember it was reported, I think, in like NME, New Musical Express, or Melody Maker in Britain, that, you know, this Lennon outtake.
Yeah.
And it was, I think it was Neil Innes who came forward and said, no, that's me.
Right, right. Because it sprang from Rutland Weekend Television.
Yeah.
Which George had already guested on.
Yes, and I saw that.
Yeah.
I remember at the time he
sings Pirate Song.
Pirate Song, that's right. And I was disappointed. It was 73 or something.
76. It was Christmas 75. Was that what it was? It was a Christmas show.
Right. And I'm waiting to hear him because he comes on, he's playing the opening chords to My Sweet Lord. I'm thinking, great. And then he goes into the pirate song, and I was not amused, I have to tell you.
Mr. George Addison sings. Pirate's life for me. All my friends are pirates and the same the BBC. I got a Jolly Roger, it's a black and white and fast. So get out of your skull and crossbones and I'll run it up your mast. Well, yo, ho, ho, and ha, 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 ha. Yo, ho, ho, and ha.
But that was the start of his comeback, you know,
yeah.
From the demons he'd had off the Dark Horse tour and Extra Texture.
But we have other things like LS Bumblebee,
yeah,
which to me never sounded like the Beatles.
There is a little insect not many people see. He's known to all the insect as the LS Bumblebee. So when you hear him coming, just throw away your tea. That psychedelic humming will mean you'll soon be free.
Oh, druggy, druggy.
Freak out, baby. The bee is coming.
It was Peter Cook and Dudley Moore.
Right. It came out in early 67, and they said that they were actually trying to imitate the Beach Boys.
Yeah, I don't know why that got, you know, thrown out there as
desperation. That word again, people are craving new Beatle product.
Yeah.
And they want anything remotely sounding Beatlesque, or at least the bootleggers, you know, having tapped the well of extant BBC recordings at the time, which they hadn't really gotten to the bottom of yet. And God knows there wasn't really the access to the EMI vaults at that time. So it was going to be years before you heard If You Got Trouble or Leave My Kitten Alone. That didn't happen until the 80s.
I mean, another one that I remember late night hearing for the first time, the ELO track, Can't Get It Out My Head.
Mm-hmm.
And which was a bit like Ron Nasty's book, Out of Me Head, in Ruttles. But,
right.
but you know, this was Jeff Lynne's Beatles/Lennon obsession reaching its apotheosis. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I just remember hearing that. It's all full of the old nows and the Lennon inflections. And I really thought it was a Lennon track.
You know,
I'm listening closely and thinking, is it him? Isn't it him? But again, it was that mindset, that desperation, wanting some more product.
Yeah, there's got to be more out there, and we'll scrape the barrels. And that's what the people producing these did. There were very few legitimate outtakes that came out during those years. Mm. I did hear Mary Jane at one point.
Yes, so did I.
It was a nice edit. I like it better than the one that ended up on Anthology, to the extent I like the song at all.
Right.
You know, and that was one they did well to shelve.
Yeah.
Although there was that.
Wasn't it the Yellow Matter Custard LP, bootleg LP, and that was basically the BBC sessions?
It was. Okay. I've got a lot to say about that because it came out under a couple different forms. Yellow Matter Custard being the earliest iteration of that. As Sweet As You Are was another version of it.
Yeah.
And the version I first bought, and it would have been 75 or so. It was called the Deco Audition Tapes. It had a nice package, which had, instead of the white sleeve with the piece of paper stuck in it, it was actually a reproduction of the Beatles' top pole of Merseybeat.
Yes,
that was on my cover. And this was the one that famously fooled John Lennon, who had been
collecting them. We've seen that note to Paul that he sends.
Yeah,
right?
yeah.
Here's us with at the Decca audition.
Right.
Doesn't even remember.
It's 1963 BBC recordings.
Yeah.
But that album hangs together so well that if they weren't touting themselves as songwriters, if they were just this great, accomplished cover band, that could have been their Please Please Me album. Yeah. It is so well sequenced. All the material is top flight.
Yeah.
You know, it starts out with I Got a Woman.
Yes.
It's got Glad All Over, the Carl Perkins That's Glad right. All Over, not the Dave Clark 5 one. I Just Don't Understand.
Does it have Margaret. Crying, Waiting, Hoping on there?
Yes, it does. Buddy Holly, the posthumous Holly release from his apartment tapes.
Yep.
Lonesome Tears in My Eyes.
Yes.
Honeymoon Song. Yep. Sure to Fall.
Yep.
So How Come No One Loves Me?
I know.
Lend Me Your Comb.
It's really the Hamburg / Liverpool repertoire.
Yeah. Of the songs they would later re-record for EMI, only Slow Down is on there.
Right.
Yeah. But it's also got the BBC take of I'm Going to Sit Right Down and Cry Over You.
Yes.
Which I think does not match the Star Club performance, but still there it is. It's cool. It is Shot of Rhythm and Blues.
Right, that's right. Now, when I first heard it, the quality wasn't great.
It's good compared to some of the stuff that came out. It's not stellar. Of course, the 94 BBC release would bring it up to snuff. Yeah. But to me, I've always felt that throwing all those tracks out there spread over two discs, two 80-minute discs, along with their own material, really diluted the power of that.
Hmm.
And if they just stuck it to the 12 or 13 or 14 songs as packaged at the Decca audition tapes, that was a powerful, well-sequenced album. It was superb. I would listen to that. I'd listen to that now for pleasure.
Now, I've got a confession to make today on this show.
Okay.
In 73, when the 62, 66, 67, 70 compilation albums came out,
Beatles
compilation albums were issued, now known as the Red and Blue. Lot of money. I was 14 years old. It was a lot of money for a 14-year-old to splash out on these two, I think, double albums.
Yes.
And had to earn some money back. So I basically, I can't remember how I said this. I think I had a cassette recording of the albums, and I had two small little cassette decks and put a microphone.
To the speaker?
Yeah, just microphone to the speaker of one of them. And I was selling copies at school to earn the money back, you know.
You were bootlegging, you were pirating the Beatles.
My excuse is I'd never even heard the word bootleg at that time. I didn't know it was anything wrong.
It was your natural thought.
It was just my, you know, just money-making, you know, scheme of mine. And
jeez.
Yeah, I know. But I do want to say that I paid all the profits to the IRS. Oh, well, actually, no, Inland Revenue.
Inland Revenue, Yeah, if not to Apple Corps directly.
There you go.
Well, I'm sure you, like me, has made it up in enriching the Beatles' bank accounts through the years that they can overlook that.
They should be grateful to us, of course.
Really?
Yeah.
In the end, they absolutely should.
Yeah.
So,
like they are to everyone.
Yeah, right, exactly. So it's funny, you were bootlegging or you're pirating legitimate releases.
Yeah.
At that time, it never even occurred to me because in my era of early fandom, there was nothing less cool than being a Beatle fan.
Right.
Like you'd alluded to it the other day on the show. They were passe. They'd broken up.
I know. By 73, it was like the Beatles, they broke up years ago. I remember an English teacher saying that to me at school in front of the whole class.
Old news, man.
Like, yeah. You're still interested in the Beatles?
Bowie.
Yeah. It was like I said. It was like I just said Al Jolson or something.
Exactly.
You know?
Right. Yeah. And that's how it was in my period of fandom where my peers are listening to Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
And Kiss, you know, that was like the stuff of the day. You know, forget the Beatles.
Right.
And so I kind of kept it to myself. But what I was doing, alongside acquiring those Dutch imports, you know, advertised in the back of Rolling Stone, was I was creating my own stuff. And there was, I remember there were so few Beatle books at the time. And anything, any media beyond the records was from the few books that were out there. You'd see still pictures of the Beatles, of course. Hard Day's Night and Help coming on local TV, you know, loaded with commercials. And to me, it was so exciting to see the Beatles in motion and performing and singing. It's like, holy cow, this is great. And so I, with my little cassette recorder and microphone, would have it to the TV speaker, and I would record cutting the commercials out, which I kind of regret now, but getting the entirety of those films on a 90-minute cassette into listening to them later for enjoyment.
Yeah.
That to me was like, wow, this is really cool.
Yeah.
And I remember in the spring of 75, here in America, they had something on late night in the 10:30 slot called ABC's Wide World of Entertainment.
I've seen that.
And it would rotate, you know, whatever thematic, you know, sometimes it would be hard news and whatever the hell else it was.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a kid, so I didn't tend to stay up to watch this stuff. But then I caught wind of, we're going to have David Frost doing a salute to the Beatles.
Oh.
I was like, holy cow, I got to get this in. So I cassette recorded it. And for its time and for my limited access to Beatle knowledge and material and all that stuff, it was gratifying.
Yeah.
In retrospect, it's crap. It's a clip job. I mean, really, a lot of it was stock stuff they had sitting in their vaults. There was, you know, they had George Martin interviewed, they had Mal Evans interviewed, and that was cool. Yeah. But a lot of it was like stuff from 1964, like, you know, a guy that was selling the sheets they slept on during their tour.
Right.
Yeah, it was all that kind
of. So you record it with a cassette recorder.
Yeah, I did.
I hope you filmed it on 8mm as well.
I didn't do that. I didn't have that capability. Damn. Only my brother had that and film was expensive, and I was delivering papers. So,
isn't it on YouTube anyway?
It's not on YouTube, but I do have a copy of it that somebody dubbed off of probably Betamax tape.
Right.
So I do have a copy of it today because I was able to write about it in one of my books. But it is kind of weird that here it is, the spring of 75. You know, Paul is about to drop Venus and Mars. John has just done Rock and Roll, Walls and Bridges. George, you know, he's working on Extra Texture. He's just done the Dark Horse Tour, which there is zero reference to at all. Right. I mean, his career ends with Bangladesh, as far as the special goes.
Right.
They've got Wings in there doing the rehearsal of Give Ireland Back to the Irish. That's how out of date this thing is.
Does it have Goodnight Vienna by Ringo?
No. That's what I mean. It's just like, this could have been done in 72.
Yeah, right.
It's just ridiculous.
It must have been done in 72.
You know, capitalizing. I mean, he had, you know, he'd interviewed John and Yoko. He'd interviewed John. He'd interviewed George and John. You know, he was sitting on stuff that apparently ABC didn't have the licensing access to.
Right.
But it could have been so much more. But, you know, this is pre-anthology.
Yeah.
This is pre-complete Beatles.
Yeah.
The Malcolm McDowell thing that came out, what, 81, 82?
I mean, this is a long time before.
So this is like
almost
prehistoric Beatle documentation. It's before All You Need Is Love.
Right.
The Tony Palmer thing.
Right.
So, you know, you had to gratefully accept what you could get.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So to me, it was like gold.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, in retrospect, it's crap. But
so these albums, anyway, getting back to these
albums.
You know, and you say Dutch imports. I mean, was it all from Holland?
No, none of it was, really. I mean, that was just what they were dubbed because if you said what they were, record retailers couldn't, after a certain amount of time, sell them in the light of day.
Right.
You know, and certainly other access points of access couldn't do that because you get busted. You literally got busted. There was a friend of mine that was there when a bust actually happened at a record show back in the 80s or 90s where the police swept in and all these people that were selling these things got literally, you know, carted off.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, the one enigma in that one was Revolver Records in New York. You remember?
Yeah. Well, we had our equivalent here.
Right.
Rolling Stone in Chicago.
Right, okay. And I was just amazed that they went for years and years and years. Everyone knew what was, you know, it was a huge store, had bootlegs out there, you know, coming out of the Wazoo.
And fan gatherings, you could buy these things.
Yeah.
In fact,
and I was just amazed that, as you said, you know, non-entities were getting busted for bootlegging.
Yes.
And yet they just kept doing it. I think they had problems a few times, but they just kept going.
I think largely the authorities would look the other way.
Why?
Why not? I mean, you're going to go after record bootleggers? You're going to go after, you know,
what I'm saying is the likes of anyone at home with, you know, a cassette-to-cassette recording facility was getting busted.
I think they felt they had to honor the law, you know, in BMI and ASCAP were probably putting pressure on them and record labels as well. So you'd have to go through the motions once in a while. But yes, up and through at least the mid-'80s, it wasn't hard to find this stuff. And you could literally go to your local record store, if it was a good one, that stocked actual imports. And a lot of times, these bootlegs would have the sticker on them, imported from Holland, imported from Germany. It was all bullshit. You know, they would have, you know, they're really pressed locally, as we found out now.
I was then getting into also, by the late 70s, early 80s, I had my first iteration of the Betamax record, my Sony Betamax, which, like, you know, it was like carting an elephant around.
You know?
I mean, it was a massive, heavy thing. But now I was heavily into the video bootlegging stuff. You know,
And that would just open up a whole other window of stuff. One of the first tapes I bought, in fact, it was at a record show, was somebody's dub who had recorded, God knows how they did it back then. I know the technology existed, but it was certainly a minority of people that had the access. They'd recorded the ABC in concert broadcast of the One-to-One show. That came out in December of 72.
Yes.
And so I bought a beta copy of that.
Yeah.
With commercials cut out.
You must likely bought it off me. But
Yeah, it could be. But it was so cool, especially ultimately in the 80s when the Live from New York came out and they used the other show.
Mm-hmm.
So I had something really unique that I preferred over the one that came out, which sounded so anemic and just weak to me.
Yes.
This one sounded much stronger.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, be that as it may. So you're in the 70s and you're wanting to suck up anything that's out there. And among the holy grails was Shea Stadium.
Yes.
Because we knew that that was properly recorded, so we thought. We didn't know at the time how much actual sweetening they'd done for that show. And in the case of Act Naturally, they slipped in the studio recording.
Absolutely.
Because it was so beyond redemption,
yeah.
apparently.
Yeah.
We knew that they'd been professionally recorded in Japan in 66. And I remember.
And Hollywood Bowl.
Hollywood Bowl, yeah. We knew those had been professionally recorded. And ultimately, they did come out in 77.
Yeah.
What we didn't know, and here's my story about that. Spring of 77, the buzz is that the Beatles are finally getting ready to put out a live album produced by George Martin. And I'm listening to an AM talk radio station in Chicago, WGN. I can't remember who the host was, but they weren't like a music station per se. Mm-hmm. They were talk. And the guy that was on the radio, who I would later find out was one of these guys who'd actually been on the Beatle tours and interviewed them when they first came to America. Anyway, he's touting, we have an advanced copy of the Beatles at the Hollywood Bowl, and we're going to air some exclusive cuts before you can actually buy it. So come listen to it. And I'm like all ears listening to this thing. And then they play You Can't Do That from the Hollywood Bowl 64 show.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what, folks? That wasn't on the release that came out from Capitol.
Right.
So they had their own bootleg that they were spinning on the air, which
yes.
I thought was pretty cool in retrospect.
Yeah.
Although I do remember my disappointment that, wait a minute, where's You Can't Do That? It's not on air. Let's hear it now.
I got something to say that might cause you pain. I got you talking to that boy again. I'm gonna let you down and leave you blind. Because I told you before, oh, you can't do that. Well, it's the second time I caught you talking to him. I have to tell you one more time, I think it's a sin. I'm gonna let you down.
Great stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we're still waiting for Apple to do a proper reissue of that.
Yes.
You know, they did the 64 show, and you've probably seen this, but they had at that show a lot of newsreel crews.
Yes.
That weren't there to document the Beatles,
mm-hmm.
but they were there to get the atmosphere, get the mania.
Yeah, the fans and yeah, all dancing. And.
But
yeah.
People have done a great job of syncing what stage shots there are to the audio and the fandom and created like a visual accompaniment to the Hollywood Bowl show.
Yes.
And I have to think, you know, you got the Ron Howard thing coming up of the Beatles Live document, and we'll be speaking to somebody that's key in that in an upcoming show. When is Apple going to put out a nice Hollywood Bowl package? There was two shows they recorded in 65, and you've heard the versions that have leaked out. One of the shows, Paul's mic's not working.
Right.
So you've got like a Paul vocalist performance of their 65 set. But even when they did put out the Hollywood Bowl show in 77, they sort of cut and paste between the two years.
Yeah.
And so there's
64 and 65. And
yeah. You're missing things like I Want to Hold Your Hand, If I Fell, I'm Down.
Yeah.
You know, any number of cuts that didn't make the cut, as it were.
They're thinking of the general public. They're not thinking of the real Beatle fans.
They're swinging for the fences.
Yeah.
It was nice when Anthology came out. They issued on one of the CD singles for Real Love, I believe, the outtake from the Hollywood Bowl 65 show, Babies in Black.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And a nice bit of intro with John, right?
Yeah. Let's play that.
We'd like to do another number, because that's what we're here for. Our poor fiddles at his amplifier. I hope you can hear me. I'd be awfully disappointed if you couldn't. We'd like to do another one from one of our LPs, albums, long players, records. Oh, you're okay. It's a slow number, and it's a waltz for all of you over 10.
I didn't see you at all.
Some people play fast waltzes and some people play slow waltzes. But we're going to play a slow one. And it's called Babies in Black.
So of the bootleg material, I think that Beatle fans were really craving, number one, a great live concert experience.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, 66 was like the last year they toured. So, you know, people were thinking it'd be great to have something from the last performance of the Beatles.
Yeah.
And the closest we got to anything that was professionally recorded were the Japan shows.
Yes.
And unfortunately, they're terrible performances. They're just very listless and weak.
Oh, horrible.
We played on the show we did, number six of the Beatles Live. We played a bit of If I Needed Someone.
Which is,
really awful.
The one, to really play.
Well, let's hear the concert opener. They'd switched in 66 from the Twist and Shout version they'd been playing to rock and roll music.
Right.
Another ripping Lennon vocal that he could not possibly hope to fulfill live night after night. But here it is. So, you know, that would be one thing, the live stuff, which ultimately got fulfilled, more or less satiating the fans with the Hollywood Bowl release.
Yes.
There were also studio outtakes. You know, we spoke to that and a lot of outfakes that came out. There weren't anything really genuine coming out at the time. Although
we'd hear, you know, things like Colliding Circles, Pink Litmus
Paper
Shirts.
Well, there was Circles. Well, that was the Martin Lewis stuff that didn't exist.
Right. Absolutely.
By the time it was in 75 that the book All Together Now came out,
yeah.
written by Wally and Harry Castleman, that went through. They had a whole bootleg chapter and what was and what wasn't.
Yeah.
And there was like a whole list of things that didn't exist. All Together on the Wireless.
Yes.
I Should Like to Live Up a Tree.
Yeah.
This Is Some Friendly. And some of these might have been alternate titles for legitimate songs, but for all you knew, they could have been unreleased Beatles songs, and all we wanted was to hear unreleased Beatles.
Another album that I remember was Watching Rainbows.
Yes. That was a great one because it had a beautiful color cover.
From the Mad Day Out.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Let's hear the title track to that, because that was a genuine Beatle composition, a John Lennon song, that they did. And historically, we didn't know this then, but it was recorded in the days after George quit.
Yes, that's right.
So it's just the three of them.
Yeah, January of 69.
Yeah, and I think it's like the 14th or so. And it was John was debuting some material, him playing electric piano, Paul playing lead guitar and Ringo on drums, Watching Rainbows, Madman.
Yes.
Yeah, so let's hear a bit of that. And these were songs that they performed and never ever returned to.
And Get Me a Drink of Water or something like that.
What was great back then, and I remember my first entering this realm, but we now were actually getting to hear the Twickenham Nagra reels, and that was a huge thing. They were being parceled out as Get Back journals, Get Back sessions, part one and two. I remember when I sprung my money for this double album that came out in 77, 78 called Sweet Apple Tracks.
Yes, I remember that.
It had the cover picture of the Revolution promo,
which
is, of course, inaccurate, but you know, it's all January 69. But this really was mind-blowing because it changed the way you listen to the Beatles.
Yes.
This was just literally tape running on them, rehearsing and bringing in new material.
Oh, it's fly-on-the-wall stuff.
Fly-on-the-wall stuff, yeah. So you get a lot of, they're joking around, false starts, going off on tangents, playing, you know, random rock and roll tunes from their youth, as well as getting on with the new material. And a lot of it would surface on Abbey Road, stuff like She Came In Through the Bathroom Window, Mean Mr. Mustard, Oh Darling.
Yeah.
And some of it ended up on the Let It Be project, and some of it was just completely abandoned.
Yeah.
And like we played in an earlier show, the I Me Mine into House of the Rising Sun, you know, to me it was fascinating and funny and just, it was wonderful stuff at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, you probably remember your first listening to that stuff.
Absolutely. For me, it was mind-blowing.
Yeah, you know, and those little, like, those beeps of...
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, throughout.
Yeah. Like, I was going to say that, the beeps, That's, which again made me feel like, ooh, you know, hearing something we shouldn't be hearing.
Yeah,
it's professional stuff. And
That real insider stuff.
Yeah,
nobody's heard this. Yeah, it was wonderful, wonderful stuff. And also, because to that point, I know, I don't know what it is for you, but my first exposure to Let It Be the film was a midnight showing back in the 70s. Sometimes they'd couple it with Yellow Submarine, sometimes with Magical Mystery Tour. But that was like a cool kind of thing to experience as a Beatle fan, where again, you sort of felt you were doing something semi-illicit.
Yeah, I saw it back in the 70s, and it was on a double bill. It was the second feature of following Johnny Cash, the man, his world, his music.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, that's
the perfect crossover of fans, isn't it?
Now, capture all kinds of audiences. Right.
Oh,
like,
man.
Really? Who's going to go and see both of those?
Right. And enjoy them.
Actually, it's a pretty good film, but at the time, I was bored stiff. I was just waiting for Let It Be to come on.
Oh, I'll have to look into it. But Let It Be. So we had a feeling of, plus Beatlefest at the time was showing it.
Yeah.
So, and I remember vividly, you know, anytime Yoko or Linda appeared on the stage or on the screen, the from the audience.
And from you, no doubt.
I was polite back then. But it was interesting because, you know, to me, we'll do a Let It Be show someday. Yeah. I think it's a terrible documentary. It's awful.
I agree.
It's not as bad filmmaking.
It most likely could be a wonderful documentary.
And how do we know this? By hearing the Niagara Reels. Even though that was like the bad phase of the project, and the good phase being the Apple Studio stuff where Billy's there and they're much more upbeat and fun. But there's plenty of fun there. So here's an example that I heard back from the Sweet Apple tracks of them going through She Came In Through the Bathroom Window, which I think is hilarious.
Glenn, can you give John a mic for the Jello Allen voice on this number?
If you just have a sort of permanent mic on the piano or a permanent mic to me.
You can hear both of them, you see, Glenn.
Eins, zwei, drei,
vier.
She came in through the bathroom window.
Yes, she did, yes, she did, now.
Protected by a silver spoon.
A bloody spoon, a bloody spoon, a bloody silver spoon.
Of course, I really had to tell her.
Slate 182, Slate 182 on B camera. The time is 1 o'clock.
This is roll 95, Slate 181 continued. Camera A.
She works at 15 clubs a day.
Working 15 clubs a day?
Yeah. And though she thought I had the answer, I just had to sail away. Speaking. Is that Paul? I'd like to have a word with you.
Isn't it amazing that that was the sort of stuff that wasn't included, you know, where it's actually upbeat, it's funny.
Yes.
You know,
they're having fun.
Yeah.
And that was the album, that was the release that gave us the whole white power, No Pakistanis.
That's right, Get Back, yeah.
Yeah, it's hilarious. And it's just, it's great that that stuff is documented. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that's mind-blowing, and we'll do a Twickenham show at some point, so we can focus on that, but where Paul is actually introducing Let It Be.
Yes.
Playing it to them
first
time.
Yeah.
Calling out the chords.
Yeah.
And he's doing like that, you know, Ringo, I want you to do this, you know, hi-hat rhythm.
Yeah.
It's incredible. It was just mind-blowing. And that was this wealth of material that found its way to the market.
Yeah, their perspective was all different then.
Yeah. But do you remember, I think it was early 81 that the Black Album came out.
That's right.
Yeah, and that was the triple record set. It was basically Sweet Apple tracks plus another disc of Twickenham Nagra Reel stuff.
Yeah. Because I was expecting it to be...
The White Album.
White Album, yeah outtakes.
Although they do I'm So Tired.
That's right.
Yeah. Let's play that.
I'm so tired, I haven't slept a wink. I'm so tired, my mind is on the blink. I wonder, should I call you and get myself a drink? No, 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 no. Lay off the booze, boy, 'cause I'm so tired. I don't know what to do, don't know what to do. I'm so tired, my mind is set on you. I wonder, should I go? No.
Paul's take, which is pretty funny.
Right, yeah.
You know, in the context a few months after they actually recorded it. But this was a gold to us as fans. Yeah. The memorable takeaway about the Black Album, did you ever own it? Did you see it?
Oh, I heard it at the time. I just didn't own it.
Yeah, it was a pricey thing. But it had the gatefold cover with pictures on the inside, not the loose ones like the actual White Album did. But the pictures inside there, the song titles, but the poster.
Yes.
That was the amazing thing.
Well, that's the thing about that album was it took bootlegs to another level, didn't it, in terms of the packaging.
That was where things really started getting interesting and cool.
Yeah.
You know, and that we were swinging into the 80s now. And this was also, too, where, you know, John Barrett was the guy at EMI.
Yes.
That was now, the vaults were being cracked open.
Yeah.
And now stuff was starting to
the
leak
vaults.
Out.
The famous vaults, folks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was always discovering something in the vaults. I had this image of, you know, going down some dungeon with cobwebs.
Yeah.
And
it's like the opening of Get Smart. Yeah. You've got all those doors to go through.
Yeah. Or sonically, the opening of Monster Mash or something, you know.
Right, right. Yeah, when you get to the final door. But that's the way we're envisioning it.
Yeah, the vaults. It was always the vaults.
Okay,
yeah.
We know differently now. But that was when I remember reading, I don't know if it was in Beatle Fan or one of those magazines that was around at the time.
Beatles Unlimited.
Or, Paperback Writer was one. Strawberry Fields Forever. But the imminent release of How Do You Do It, which had already been bootlegged through Joe Pope.
Oh, yeah. And that was another mind blower for me, by the way, when the first time I heard
that. Let's talk
about
that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. How Do You Do It? Yeah. A song we'd read about.
Yes.
Like alongside the Decca audition tapes.
Yeah.
You've been reading about these songs, you know, Three Cool Cats and Sheik of Araby. And it was, I think, 75. I write about it in Solo in the 70s.
Yeah.
I should read it someday. They were issued through Joe Pope, who got his hands on a tape from somebody in England.
This it was out of Boston, Joe Pope.
Yeah, Boston Joe Pope. I think he paid $3,000 for a dub of the Decca audition reel.
Right.
And he started issuing them, and he went all out, first class.
Yeah.
He released the tracks. He paired them as singles on colored vinyl, beautiful color picture sleeves, and they were being sold, you know, through the magazine and through Beatle Fest at the time. Beautiful stuff. And we just ate that up, boy.
Oh, my God. I remember when I first heard How Do You Do It, that was one I was showing off to people, like, listen to this.
Do you remember the flip?
What was the flip on that?
The live take, the promo take of Revolution. The shooby-doo-bop fast version.
That's right. That's right. Yes.
And I don't think Joe Pope was responsible, but it followed his presentation template.
But I just remember having that like as if it was like an ace up my sleeve. Listen to this. You've never heard this. The Beatles doing How Do You Do It.
Right.
And we're going, wow, you know.
And that's the thing anymore now. We've heard everything to a fault.
Yeah.
Every outtake, every different alternative mix.
Yeah.
But we don't have the excitement that we did in the 70s.
Right, because another one that was absolutely mind-blowing for me was, and I remember the label was Very Queen. It was V-E-W-Y and then Queen, as in the Queen of England. Uh-huh. And that was for a bootleg of the Royal Variety performance of the four tracks.
Right, on a single, right?
Yeah, it was like an EP.
Yeah, yeah. I've got that as well.
And I remember the label was Very Queen. It's certainly the one I had. And,
I don't remember that being the one that I have. I associate it with the Joe Pope line of things.
But my God, that was like gold dust for me, hearing that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, hearing...
Rattle Your Jewelry.
Yeah. Wow.
Where else? There was no YouTube.
No.
Yeah, there was no anthology.
Which brings me to that. You know, a lot of people listening to this now are just used to the YouTube.
Right. And they're like, kind of like, so what, guys?
Yeah, exactly. You know, which is, it's amazing now. But I'm glad that I've actually traveled this journey, that I appreciate it. You
yes.
know, because, as you said, we were just hanging on to these bootlegs.
Right. We had yeah. nothing. The whole thing started, funnily enough, with the Let It Be project, not the actual Nagra stuff, because that came mm. later, but it was the Glyn Johns mixes,
right.
you know, where they gave him the tapes and said, make an album.
Yeah, there were two versions.
Right, he did a couple yeah. takes of it, yeah. and it had some rooftop stuff on it,
yeah.
it had some different studio things with the chatter, with that live ambiance.
It was, as Lennon said, the Beatles with their trousers down yeah. with that, the unvarnished version.
Let's put the shitty version out and yeah. break the myth.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's fascinating. I know there's a lot of people that will favorably compare that to what ultimately came out of Let It Be Naked. You know, I think thematically it works because you do have that sense of being the fly on the wall. And it's not bad. I mean, would you compare the Glyn Johns take of Don't Let Me Down, which I guess was from the first day Billy Preston played with
yes.
them, Take It, Bill, to the finished master? Of course not, but it's not right. meant to compete with it.
Correct.
It's an audio document is
yeah.
what it is.
Yeah.
And it's great stuff. And apparently, somebody in the fall of 69 pirated out an acetate of one of the Glyn Johns things, and it got played on a Buffalo, New York radio station.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, fans are out there recording on their cassettes and reel-to-reels. And that became the first Beatle bootleg. I think it was called Get Back, because mm-hmm. people would have been familiar with the song Get Back by then.
Yeah.
It was called the Get Back album. And so in late 69, just after Abbey Road, that starts floating out there. It's got the plain white cover with the stamp on it. You know, a Beatles Get Back. And there was Get Back to Toronto, where they did a revision of it a couple years later with one of John's peace messages on it. They'd augmented it. But that was how people first got to hear the Let It Be album prior to it coming out in May of 1970.
Well, we got a lot to be thankful to bootleggers for. I mean, you know, also just we refer to the BBC tapes.
Yeah.
As we know, some of those sessions, the BBC wiped.
Yes.
And it's only thanks to bootleggers that they managed through research to find people who recorded off the radio.
Right, preserve that stuff.
Yeah, most likely with a microphone next yeah. to the radio, whatever.
Shushing and people coming near.
Yeah, and preserved it for yep. forever, you know, really grateful to those people.
It's the fans that really saw the value early on.
I love the footage also, and some photos from the Beatles' first U.S. concert, the Washington Coliseum in February of 64.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, I remember particularly one girl there in her sort of 1960s glasses, you know, with the
yeah.
pointy frames, and sitting there with a little recorder on her lap.
Right.
It must be a little reel-to-reel because it
right.
was pre-cassette.
Yeah.
So a little reel-to-reel on her lap and holding the microphone up in the front row there, just openly, no one getting on her case about
right.
this.
You could do that back
yeah.
then
yeah.
and nobody would fault you because right. you'd paid your $5.
Well, because there wasn't really a market for it, right?
It was
you know,
private listening.
Just,
yep.
Yeah, exactly, private
right.
listening.
I don't think anybody was exchanging tapes back then.
Right.
But it is funny that you go talk about the live stuff. Some of the more worthy things were, if not professionally recorded like the Hollywood Bowl, at least were
Sam Houston Coliseum.
Yeah, Sam Houston. Oh, I'm glad you brought that up because that's a great show.
Yeah.
Not for the performance so much as
Lennon's voice is shot.
Yeah, yeah, the documentation of Beatle fandom
yeah.
in action.
Absolutely. The guy's telling the audience to shut up, basically.
Yeah, he does that. And there was two versions of that that came out. There was like the double set of the afternoon and the evening show.
Yeah.
And then there was a single disc one. But let's play a bit of that where
let's play the bit where the guy's telling the audience to come down before they come on.
Okay, and like I said, there's also where he stops the show.
Right, yeah, let's segue into that.
We're just getting the drum. Be still a minute. We're just putting the drum up here. Just add the drum. Okay. Ladies, hold it. Hold it. Quiet. 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 Ladies and gentlemen, for the first time in Houston, the Beatles. The Beatles. Please, ladies and gentlemen, please. Please, would you move back? Quiet, quiet, please. People are getting hurt on the front two rows. The show will be stopped if you don't move back. This is the Houston Security Beatle Division. Move back, please. I've been told to make this announcement. The show will be stopped if you don't move back in the first two rows. And the fellow on my right, okay, go on. Just move back, please. Okay. Oh, thank you very much. That was wonderful.
Great, great stuff. I remember the first time I
yeah.
heard this.
And, yeah.
You know,
I was blown away by the audio quality.
Right,
know?
The soundboard quality.
Yeah.
And it's such a encapsulation of what it was like. Here's the Beatles at the peak of their powers. It's like, who needs Shea? Because this has really got the experience where you can not only get the sense of the fans, but the sense of the people that were running the show, how the Beatles themselves were viewing it. There's all these little asides of them reacting to what's going on around them. But this was their first tour of stadium shows. They've never played before 50,000 people before, and it's just mind-blowing.
Yeah.
And I think by the end of that tour, they'd said, okay, we've done this now. Mm. Can we wind the game down? Because, you know, they go back in the studio and start working on Rubber Soul, and yeah, we can work it out in Day Tripper. So
yeah,
I think they realized they were coming to the end of this phase of their career.
Yeah.
Once they'd had that taste of, well, what do we do from this point? We can't hear ourselves, and they can't hear us, so why are we doing this?
I want to go back to what we were talking about before, you know, the Get Back sessions, Let It Be. I don't know about you. I've never been one of those people who's like, you know, just fascinated by every cough and every fart that was recorded by the Beatles, you know. And I think pretty quickly when I started getting into some of the Get Back sessions bootlegs, mm-hmm, you know, kind of grew bored pretty quickly and sort of think, God, this is crappy. You know, I don't like this stuff.
You're really getting a sense of who they were.
I was searching for some good, worthy stuff.
Right.
And I was actually quite quickly disappointed and thinking, this is just terrible.
Mm-hmm.
How about you? Were you like really into like just fascinated by everything that you could get your hands on?
Well, past a certain point, and now fast forward to the 90s, and the stuff is coming out crystal clear quality on CD. And
I'm actually talking way earlier. I'm talking.
Oh, okay. Here. Well, I mean, Sweet Apple Tracks was like the apex of Twickenham for me.
Yeah.
And there was much, much more. That was just the tip of the iceberg.
But other stuff started coming out.
It started coming out, and it wasn't as great. Yeah. And I think, you know, once I kind of recognized the lay of the land and what was there.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, I still remember the first time I heard the Beatles' take of All Things Must Pass.
Right.
I was blown away.
Yeah,
thinking, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And I just recognized past a certain point, I don't need to hear every take of Get Back or of Don't Let Me Down or One After Night.
I enjoyed Get Back, Pakistanis, you know. And,
yeah, yeah.
You know, that
and there's
fun.
The fast one they did the day George walked out, with John kind of bungling his way through the vocals.
Yeah.
And he's got that Ringo drum break in it. It's a great performance.
Yeah.
And they did other ones that were, you know, funny piss takes. Like
I also liked
Paul singing it in German.
Right.
Yeah.
I also liked in Let It Be the fast version of Two of Us.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Right. Yeah, yeah. So there was stuff of interest, but there was just so much of it.
Yes.
And that also became the issue during the download era, where you can hear every take of every recording on every album. It's like, how much of this do you really want to sit through?
Right.
You know, and that's where you kind of, you know, want somebody to filter it for you so you can hear the best stuff.
Yeah.
You know, Rock Band was huge because you get to hear the isolated tracks.
Yes.
Which was, you know, a great boon just when you thought it had all been played out. Well, guess what? We can take it a step deeper and learn something as we've played through our shows. You know, the isolated vocals, isolated bass.
I mean, it really, I don't know about you, but I hadn't heard until Anthology came out. I never heard the, you know, Pete Best version of Love Me Do.
No one had.
For example, right?
Right, that hadn't been booted.
Yeah, so that was like a big one for me hearing that. And another one on Anthology 2 album was the outtake of And Your Bird Can Sing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where they sound like they're high, basically. They, you know, they certainly got the giggles over something.
You could probably pare down all the anthologies to a single release of like real, you know, genuinely insightful recordings that where it doesn't become redundant after a while.
Yeah,
you know, they should do a freestanding Esher demo release of everything.
Yeah, because I've got all of that.
Yeah, that's we've fantastic. Got it. It's all been bootleg, just like the Star Club.
Yeah.
But you know, an officially sanctioned one that just focuses all, you know, tightly focused releases was really where they should go with this stuff.
Well, it's amazing. I think Goodbye's never been Paul's demo of Goodbye's never been officially released,
right.
Has it?
No,
because I think on an earlier show I was assuming it was part of Anthology and. Right. Realize it wasn't actually.
Right, right. You assume this because it all melds after a while.
Yeah.
You know, you've heard it and all that, but no, they have these arbitrary standards. I didn't think it was. I mean, I understand the business sense behind putting out the BBC packages the way they do. I don't think more is more.
No.
I think if they'd done them as single albums and just programmed them and sequenced them, you know, keep the original Beatle material apart from the covers. The covers are fascinating in their own right. As standalone releases showing what influences they were absorbing and what might have manifested itself later, You know, like Lonesome Tears in My Eyes is like, you could see where Ballad of John and Yoko's guitar motif came from.
Yeah.
You know, and that's great. I don't necessarily need to hear BBC recordings of I Feel Fine or any of their studio recordings because they're never going to be better than the studio recordings.
I don't know
about
you. Me personally, in terms of wanting to hear unreleased recordings or, you know, just outtakes things, I'm more interested in kind of very early, even pre-fame, you know, like very early or very late. I'm not so, you know, taken by, as I said, there is some really good stuff from the middle period, you know, but I don't know, that's just not where my interest goes.
I mean, I like hearing the different stages of Strawberry Fields.
Yeah.
I think that that was like them really, that was a real high as a collective creative entity.
Yeah.
All of them working together on that and his various, you know, sort of breaking down after that.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. So, you know, there'd been all kinds of stuff covering different periods of their career. Not so much White Album, but, you know, you got Twickenham and Let It Be to a Fault, like over covered and booted. I remember Abbey Road seemed to be the missing piece. You know, that was like, you know, well, what about the last thing they did? Where's the outtakes of that?
Right.
And eventually the one came out, which was, it was that Linda picture of the four of them sitting on the steps of EMI.
Yes.
It's called Abbey Road Number 3, Northwest. And it was half an album, because half of it is, if you've heard it, it was Paul and Donovan. Like, just somebody was running tape on them, I think, when they were doing the Mary Hopkin album.
Donovan showing Paul how to play guitar, isn't it?
the finger picking. Yeah. But now, by that time, I think he would have had it. But the first half was, it was the great outtakes of, like, the basic tracks before they built on them for the final master of You Never Give Me Your Money.
Right.
There was an outtake of Something. But the thing that was kind of cool, speaking of Something, as sort of revelatory, was originally it was like a 7-minute song.
Yeah.
And it had that whole piano coda to it.
Yes.
Now, Lennon, actually, that was a song of George's he showed up for, because he plays the piano on there.
Right.
And he plays this unrelated chord sequence at the conclusion of the song that was the same chord pattern he would use a year later for Remember.
Right. I just wonder if it was ever really being seriously considered.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, they lopped it right off. But you think of it in a way, it's sort of the precursor to Layla.
Yes.
We've got that freestanding song.
That's
and
right.
The coda.
Jim Gordon. Yeah.
You can't, like, separate them. It is of a piece.
Yeah.
And Something could have been like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe they'd lop it off for the commercial single release, or maybe George was going for a Hey Jude of his own with a 7-minute song. But
right.
It's kind of cool to hear that. So let's hear a bit of that.
8-track to 8-track, Something, take 37.
Something in the way she moves attracts me like no other lover. Something in the way she woos me. I don't want to leave her now. You know I believe in how. Smile, she knows that I don't need no other lover. Something in her style that shows me that I don't want to leave her now. You know I believe in how.
So that's kind of cool.
It is cool, actually, yeah.
Giving some insight into the way they're thinking creatively of doing something different, not repeat themselves.
Right, right.
They already had the medley going, so what else can we do to make this album groundbreaking?
I mean, that's the great thing with some of these bootlegs. It kind of gives you insight into their own thought processes, how they, you know, the various sort of evolutions, if you like, of the assorted tracks, right?
And you can look at it as they're listening to what's going on around them in the rock world, where people are stretching out. There's a bit more jamming being put on records.
Yeah.
You know, the Beatles weren't a jamming band. And notwithstanding that 12-minute plotting version of Helter Skelter, that was never seriously entertained for release.
Right.
But here they could do something groundbreaking within their skill set, as it were. They just ultimately didn't go with it because they were their own best quality control.
Yes.
And they thought, nah, you know, we don't need it. But they repurposed it. They came around and reused that part.
Yeah.
Over.
But, so, I mean, you know, you referred to before Strawberry Fields. And again, fantastic, right, what we've got there.
The original takes that were perfectly releasable.
Absolutely.
But they weren't there yet.
Right. But you hear also the compositional.
Yeah, the evolution of that.
Yeah. So that's a wonderful thing about some of these bootlegs, not just the interest of, oh, here's something different.
Right.
But we actually get into the thought processes.
You learn something.
Yeah, the work methods.
You know, you can interview Paul McCartney tomorrow, and you're not going to get the same kind of insight.
No way.
When you were working on Abbey Road, what were you thinking about? You know, he's going to have whatever his stock answer is now.
Yeah, really.
And it's
going to call it Everest.
Yeah, right. Right. It's like the George Martin kidnapping clip. You know, we know the stories. Thank you.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
What we want is this contemporaneous insight. There's nothing better than the audio documentation. Right.
And we're going to play out now with You Never Give Me Your Money.
The basic track that was embellished. This is, he recut the lead vocal, of course, but here, to my ears, it sounds like the master they used of the George Harrison and Ringo performance, at least, and probably Paul's piano.
Yeah.
But here it is with the cold ending.
Yeah. So, thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of Something about the Beatles. Beatles. I'm Richard Buskin.
I'm Robert.
See you soon.
Money spent. Something About the Beatles. Recorded at Strad Studios, produced by Thomas Rapetney. Executive producer, Rick Way. Title song recorded by the Gorgies.